Welcome to the Reaction Podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, introducing the best of the conversations from the Reaction editors and guests in the last week. This week, the podcast is being published on Monday, so the conversations you're about to hear were recorded last week. Last week saw the growing backlash against Rishi Sunak's budget. Editor Ian Martin spoke to Maggie Pagano about the situation.
Maggie, we're going to talk a bit today about the budget. We're talking 48 hours or so since Rishi Sunak unveiled tax and spending measures in the UK. A very big deal, big financial event, huge amount of media coverage. What did you make of it?
After listening to it for, 50 minutes, an hour, I thought I never, ever want to hear another budget again. And I also thought that we need to reform our budget system. It seems to me that it is the most inefficient way of running a country's finances, the way it had become. It seemed to me, we'll talk about the big numbers and where it went in a minute, but a lot of fiddling, a lot more paperwork. We've got, 171 pages of tax already. It's just we're overcomplicating everything. And you know, the first rule of oligopoly is that people will continue doing so. And we need to break the stranglehold. So that's my sort of rant. And I'm sure you agree. It's just, you know, it's more work for the tax accountants. We know the very rich will be able to pay the tax accountants to make sure they don't pay so much tax. And the middle Britain is going to be squeezed to the pips. The big number really was the money going on health, now 44%, I think, of total spending. Now, spending on health can be infinite, and the big numbers sort of almost irrelevant. My worry is that what we need desperately in Britain is supposedly more doctors, nurses, hands-on, and reforming what these people do. My fear is when you get more money just being plugged in, it's just going to go into management. I'm wary of using the word reform because everyone will go, oh God, you want to break it up. I'm not talking that. There's obviously a lot of work that needs to be done within the NHS. So that's one comment. I think freezing personal allowances for the next 4 years, which will bring the revenue a lot of money actually in real terms.
It's a huge tax hike.
It's huge, 121% or something. Very big tax hike at a time of rising prices and inflation. And as we saw, mortgage rates already nibbling up. Yeah. So it's going to be a very tough time for a lot of those in a middle income earning from 22 to 70, 80, who are just about managing. I was about to use that terrible
like
expression.
Like you, I don't really like budgets. I don't think it's a very sensible way to construct national policy. I also really dislike the political hoopla around it, and the in the hours that follow. Tory loyalists or Labour loyalists in under Brown's stewardship saying, well, you know, it's absolutely marvellous, brilliant, you know, cheered to the rafters, and actually budgets always fall apart, but you only really discover the real story. It used to be you discovered the real story in the Sunday papers, and that's now now sped up by social media and people in certain think tanks like the IFS and the Resolution Foundation sort of digging through stuff in real time and then announcing hours later where the tax hikes really are and where the burden really falls. The thing that concerns me most about it, I mean, obviously with my instincts on these things, I'm deeply concerned about the state becoming this big, deeply concerned that we are, as you describe, spending that much money on health, which is Rupert Harrison, who's former chief of staff to George Osborne, and now in the city, and always worth listening to. I mean, he made the fair point on the NHS that this is a product of democratic choices and the government following essentially public opinion. Yeah. It's what the voters that the Tories feel that they need to win or to win again. That's what they want. Ever larger sums of spending on the NHS. Yeah. To which I'd say, well, I take that.
I can see
the political logic for it, but not necessarily the economic sense, and not when it seems to be impossible to have a serious discussion about reform. I disagree with you slightly on the management point. And I think maybe the NHS is a massive organization. It needs proper management, yeah. But how can that
work?
How can that money, how can that resource be made to work, to go further, which is, you know, in the early 2000s, the Blair government had some success, considerable success, with the agreements on that were constructed on bringing in the private sector, which, horror, that means bringing in private institutions who might make a profit, but using their excess capacity and expertise to manage down the waiting list. So that was a success. But I suppose my bigger concern is about just how confused and confusing it all is in terms of the signals it sends about where Britain is going. Because there was that little section at the end where Rishi Sunak said, look, I'm a small state person, really. I'm a pro-market person. The state, there are dangers in the state having become too big. But that is, he was then criticizing essentially his own budget. And the logic seems to be that, well, he'll run the economy because Boris wants to run it. He'll run the state like this, you know, hot for the next couple of years, spending huge amounts of money. And that will then create scope for tax cuts at some point before the next election. But that all seems to me far too tricksy. What Britain needs now is, you need a really clear story about innovation and growth and investment. And I don't know about you, Maggie, but the conversations I have with people, I've had two conversations this week with serious people who are invested in the UK and just looking at the British political situation, slightly freaked out by the aftermath of Brexit, but just getting all these contradictory signals from government. Yeah. On the one hand, saying Britain has this great kind of technological future, life sciences, pro-entrepreneurship. And then on the other hand, taxes are going through the roof, effectively, and the unreformed state is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, they can't both be true. So I just think the signal it sends is, it doesn't say come to Britain, which is post-Brexit really setting about becoming competitive on taxation, high growth economy, serious about tackling its productivity issues, really interested in automation, really interested in in modernization. It says, you know, high tax. It says high tax and potentially even low growth as well when you track through the figures.
I mean, even worse than those who want to invest in Britain is surely those who live in Britain and want to start their own businesses. There was nothing there to invite anybody to want to go and risk their own capital. And I'm very disappointed in Sunak. I mean, we know there's always a tension between a prime minister and a chancellor, that 'twas ever thus and has been for the last 40 years. And I don't expect him to have resigned, but that last little bit was sort of, you know, saying to the hangman, honestly, I'm innocent, Gov, you know? It was a bit pathetic, really. And do we... It's just not credible that over the next 2 years they'll cut taxes. I mean, that's just nonsense. Not when they've frozen allowances, which is basically a tax hike over that period. So really, really disappointed. Lots of fiddling, lots of gimmicks, as you say. Messed around with the apprenticeship levy. You know, we do need more skills. We need more incentives for innovation, which we do brilliantly, as we've both talked about before, life sciences, AI, fintech. We've got fantastic skills, knowledge base, and we need to improve it. And there was nothing there that would make anybody want to set up their own business or to risk their capital. That's so disappointing.
The other observation I would make would be about the numbers and the data. Quite a lot of argument on, well, there's always argument on Twitter, but in the political and media classes, quite a lot of argument around the OBR
the 6.5
numbers and what do they mean. Look at the estimates they're making on how Brexit has hit exports and the impact it's had on GDP. The OBR's then making some fairly heroic assumptions, as the Bank of England is, I think, on inflation, which will just sort of magically return somewhere closer to target at some point in 20, late 2022 or early 23. And I got into a discussion with various people about this, and I think I'm not trying to be too apocalyptic about it. I'm not saying that there's some massive economic explosion coming, but if you look at the way in which the data or the projections has been so wrong since early this year, but it even goes back to the start of the crisis as well, is that I can understand why the authorities have to do it and have to attach numbers to things, because people have become, post Gordon Brown, obsessed with modeling and what does next year look like and the year after look like, which actually is not really how chancellors used to present these things, because the answer is you don't know. But particularly after a pandemic and after the disruption of Brexit, and people are saying, well, look, the OBR says this is -2.6%, and that'll be 1.4%. And it is, I'm sorry to break it to people, almost completely bogus. It carries about as much credibility as the credibility of one of the major banks saying in the spring of 2007, we're not exposed to subprime at all, and we're very confident about growth for 2008, 2009. There are so many variables here in terms of global trade patterns, and also the number that needs to be done on central banks and the aftermath of QE, which, as I have to say, a former finance minister said to me this week at a party, I don't understand it. And I don't think the Bank of England fully understand how you, having done QE, how you unwind it and what effects that will then have on the economy. I stress again, hopefully it'll be okay. But all of this stuff that we've seen written about, you know, next year will look like X, and then the following year there'll be tax cuts, and then there'll be a massive push towards an election, and the Tories will probably win a majority, and you can map these things out. It's just absolute nonsense.
That's very optimistic. And if they do put up interest rates, and we see people in this middle who, you and I have lived through 15% interest rates jacking up, but this younger generation, if their mortgage payments start doubling, and there's no and tax has been squeezed, you're going to have real problems. Plus, we haven't talked about the corporation tax going up from 19 to 25%. I mean, it's not often I agree with Danny Blanchflower, but, if we see interest rates go, I can see us being tipped into recession, actually. Whereas
It's not implausible. I mean, it is, that if you, we talked about this, didn't we? I think last week, Maggie, the bets that traders are making on rates and the authorities' policies is essentially that they think rates are going to rise probably a bit faster than people think, and then they'll have to be cut because the combined impact of increased interest rates, which is actually it's not going to be a huge amount involved, but still just that upward pressure.
And
who really knows how temporary the inflation thing is? Mm. That combined with the tax increases does not suggest huge consumer confidence or investor confidence in 6 months or a year's time. So you could get some kind of downturn, at which point they then have to cut rates again. So the whole scenario is very confused, subject to external shocks.
And I think
a lot of the coverage this week took for granted was based on assuming that the numbers which the government and the OBR and the government have built their models on are correct. I mean, who the hell knows? I just wanted to ask you final question, Maggie, about labor, which obviously is the other side of this, is if there is further economic dislocation, then surely that should be theoretically good for the labor opposition. How did they do this week in terms of responding? And it wasn't Starmer.
Yeah, no, it wasn't Starmer. And that's my other really argument with the budget. It's such a set piece. The opposition has to stand up and criticise it. They have this pat piece. They can't really get to it. There's no real debate. These are issues of national importance, and almost some of them should be cross-party, but that's another. No, I thought Rachel Reeves did very well. there is a wonderful irony here. If Starmer and Rachel Reeves could pick up, if you like, pick up the small business enterprise vote, talk to them directly. They had an idea on business rates. I don't necessarily agree with that. But, you know, if they could just wake up and see that they do talk to, I mean, I hate the expression, but the ordinary man in the street, who is actually quite entrepreneurial. Most people would have something on the side and want to do. If they could speak to that, the Conservative Prime Minister, Keynesian, and then...
But then they're economically, they're inhibited from doing that by ideology, aren't they? I mean, I agree with you. I thought Rachel Reeves was, from a theatrical point of view, and also having to do it late. It was only, I think, 15 minutes before PMQs that she knew that Starmer couldn't be there because of COVID related reasons. So the performance was impressive. Mm. Also, I think I would highlight Bridget Phillipson, who's the shadow chief secretary to the Treasury. I'm probably not doing her any favors here, particularly considering how left the Labour Party is. That it just reminded me a bit of the early, the early Blair and Brown performances when you saw them. You know, when Kinnock was leader, and then under John Smith, you can see there are signs of life.
Yeah.
In the Labour Party, and Phillipson, I think, is someone to watch, but they can't really turn around and say, "Look, the government's spending too much money."
They can say spending it in the wrong way.
Possibly, but wasn't it essentially a Labour budget, which is that's what the politics of it are. It is trying to defend that Tory 80 seat majority and maybe even increase it in a few years' time.
Well, in a way, that's what the Tories want you to think, isn't it? Because they want to annihilate, if you like, the opposition. But if Labour are a bit clever, sit down, dissect this, they say, great, you know, the spending is very good, but actually we need to be doing it like this, and we need to be doing more for enterprise and small businesses, and look at tax rates, simplification. They can steal their clothes. Maybe we can have a trade-off between the two parties.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
Or a new political party, Ian.
Never works.
Well, just a little bit.
I think Chuka Amuna tried that with limited success.
But I'd like to see a little bit more dissent on the Tory benches, wouldn't you? I mean,
I think it's kind of pathetic at the moment. Yes, there is. I mean, there are a few people speaking out. I think people are just a bit stunned after the pandemic. Yeah. Also not sure how the politics of all of this is going to develop. Worried about the smarter ones, worried about what lies ahead in terms of the economy for the next 6 months, for a year. But yes, I agree with you that people are just a bit stunned and a bit beaten down, but we'll see.
Every week, the Reaction editors and their guests pick the stories from the media that interested them. On this week's instalment of Press Review, Ian Martin spoke to Maggie Bergano and Alistair Benn about everything from the insider story of Insulate Britain to the new Netflix hit Squid Game.
We're going to go first to you, Alistair, with a pick from Unheard, I think.
Yeah, so it's a video hosted by Aris Roussinos, who's one of the contributing writers. And it's a kind of 20-minute long YouTube video of him accompanying an Insulate Britain cadre, I would call them, a sort of, you know, well, I think maybe that's how they think of themselves, but he goes basically to a meeting before they do one of these, it's actually before they blocked a road coming off Southwark Bridge a few weeks ago. And he goes to a meeting they have before, and it's the most kind of in-depth thing I've seen on Insulate Britain, and kind of gets inside, you know, the questions are good, and they give quite interesting answers to his questions. I really recommend it, just to kind of clarify, you know, the demographic is primarily old, it's very white, and it's actually quite posh in a funny way. You know, there's a chap called Biff, and you know, they're all from, you know, kind of quite nice parts of England, like Cambridge or whatever. And then he kind of films the actual demo And you kind of get a real distillation, which often emerges from these videos anyway, is of basically tradespeople trying to go to their work, which presumably, you know, that they depend on in terms of, you know, deadlines and people expecting you, and their frustration playing out with these protesters who are very good at being very infuriating, you know, going limp, not moving, responding with in a very high-handed way. And I thought, so it's all that. But then there was a comment that Roussinos makes, which I just didn't really agree with. And after the meeting, when they're all saying, well, you know, if we don't do X, X, X and Y and Z in the next 1-2 years, although it's never quite clear what X, Y and Z is, or what would, justify discontinuing these actions, he sort of goes, well, they're lovely, nice, like middle-class people. They're all really well-meaning. And I just thought, yeah, well, of course they sound nice, but let's put, like, I'm quite skeptical about that kind of, I think the last few years I've become quite like radicalized about class and how it still affects the way we see people. And I thought, no, the message of that video, which he does point out, to be fair, at the end of the video, is that the police sort of treat them in a nice way because they're seemingly nice people for one thing. And two, they speak, they're very articulate, they're university educated, all that. You know, they're very, you know, nice, and you can imagine them at coffee mornings, whatever. But there is a huge class dimension to that. People like that get an easier ride with the institutions. But in general, because they get more airtime. They're listened more. Their arguments are seen as more sophisticated. And I thought, I don't think this is really about the environmental question, and it's not about what we're doing in terms of climate change, and it's nothing to do with that. I think it's a kind of, and I think, again, to give him credit, I think that's what emerges from the video, and he skillfully draws it out, but it is about a kind of identity crisis within the English middle class, and a kind of feeling of political change moving in against them, or the tides of history moving in the wrong direction.
Well, possibly, and a real
being middle class doesn't make people nice. That comes across very strongly in the film. I mean, it is illuminating because it is, I mean, it's billed as inside insulate Britain. That's quite captivating, really, to actually listen to these people who, as you said, usually you just glimpse being dragged off the road, preventing plumbers, electricians and people who work in supermarkets and keep the country going from getting to their work. And I think you put your finger on something there, Alistair, in the way in which they're given almost too much of an easy ride because of their class status. You said that they were articulate. I know what you mean. And yes, in one level and one sort of vacuous way, they are theoretically on a surface level articulate, but I found the level of their sort of thought process and analysis just juvenile. I mean, it would be an insult to student politicians to say that it was a student political level. Student politics is far more sophisticated than much of the analysis on the recording, for which I don't think they were given a tough enough time. I mean, there's one guy who admits that he's paid down his mortgage, he's on his pension, he has the time, he's clearly affluent, he's done really quite well out of the whether it's the capitalist model or the mixed economy model. He's in his 70s. He has the time to disrupt other people trying to get to their job, and he describes it as preventing humanity going down the pan. That how can these people get into their cars, drive to work when they know that humanity is about to become extinct? I mean, this is sort of a childlike level of analysis about a highly complex problem, environmental damage. I mean, I think even the most, nuts or the environmentalists who'll be gathering to protest that COP26 isn't doing enough, even most of them wouldn't say that humanity is about to become extinct. Maggie, am I being too harsh?
No, what would I haven't seen the film, but what I'd love to know, what intrigues me, is how do we think these people, and you described, as you say, a very specific demographic, how they got to these views? Is it that they've, if you like, been radicalized by their children? Are they so affluent and well off? You know, they don't need half-time jobs or hobbies or look after grandchildren. So they've got time on their hands. Have they been captured by this? And as you say, their arguments are really childlike, juvenile, and don't stack up. And these
it must be partly in the period that they have been adults, one of the most positive developments in global politics. And it begins arguably in the 60s, in the late 60s, maybe even earlier, if you want to go back to what happened in the US in the early 20th century, the reconnection with nature. But in Western Europe in the 60s, there's a big move towards saying, actually, look, industrial development might be great, but it comes with these downsides, these costs. Mm. Look at the damage that we're doing to wildlife. All of that is very positive.
But development. That's quite isn't it?
It's the politics actually of the Duke of Edinburgh rather than the Prince of Wales.
Yeah.
And that is that process is positive. That's the backdrop to their adult lives and their working lives as a concern for the environment. That's a positive thing. But what they manifest is a religious impulse, so something that is a replacement for religion. A bit like the extreme woke element as well, which is that look, if you don't do what I say politically, and you don't buy into my argument, what you're advocating is essentially the end of humanity and Armageddon. That this, I have seen the truth, which gives me a kind of calm, smug certainty that I'm absolutely right. I have seen the truth. You are too stupid or too working class or too lower middle class or not wealthy enough. You just haven't seen the truth. So take it for granted because I am your social superior. I have access to this truth. That then gives me license to stop you going to work and it gives me license to do whatever I deem required to prevent the extinction of humanity. It's completely bonkers. But I think so. We've talked a lot about one story and we've got six to get through. So I'm just going to move on to yours, Maggie. You have a story about, and there's a lot of this at the moment. There's a good piece in The Observer last week by, I think, Emma Kavanagh about why are people feeling on edge? What is it post-crisis that has, that leaves people feeling, a lot of people feeling really a bit down? She's a psychologist who diagnosed it as essentially it's survivor trauma because people have been through a pandemic and are a bit stunned in the aftermath. You wanted to highlight another piece from the New Statesman.
Yeah, another piece. It's actually last week's New Statesman, but I think it's so apposite. And I'm actually hearing the headline is, you know, why are people so exhausted? And I'm hearing it from colleagues, friends, family members, that as they've sort of re-entered society again, everybody's exhausted and a lot of people don't want to go out anymore. And this piece highlights a study carried out, I think, by the same psychologists that you mentioned, Kavanagh, and others who looked at post-disasters, but also at people, explorers, who've had to live in isolation in places like Antarctica for a long time to try and explain it. And so what the psychologist says is that the brain slows down. So when we were during lockdown, it got used to being quiet. It got used to not having lots of different experiences and impulses. And so this sort of rush to get back to normal, the brain has basically gone into overload. And that's why people are feeling tired and stressed. And she said the people who are feeling it the worst, who went straight in after Freedom Day and had an adrenaline rush and knocked out. And that actually that it will take some time for the brain, because the brain controls the limbic system, which is all the sort of emotional whatever. So, you know, we should, I suppose, basically just relax. It will come back. We will be back to normal. But also accept that we have been through some sort of, you know, quite traumatic event. So we shouldn't just say to people, don't be silly. You should be happy to be out and about. It's a real phenomenon.
Now, Alistair, I'm not attempting to turn you into a spokesman for a generation. I realised I was going to ask you there. How's your generation feeling about it? That was a completely ridiculous way to frame it. But your generation, how's it feeling about this return?
No, it's a burden to be the spokesman of the 25 to 30s.
Study says it's across generations, so you can get out of that one, Alistair. You don't have to be on this board.
I'm fist to fiddle. I feel great. I'm not tired. I'm up for it. You know, no, I everyone's knackered and exhausted. And I wonder whether, I don't think it's just, I think that kind of, the kind of that explanation is really interesting. Like the kind of, that there are sort of genuine sort of physiological realities at play. Yeah. But I'm not qualified to speak about it, but I wonder if there's another sort of explanation, which is that, you know, you're just, it's the constant ramping up. I think it was a twofold thing. It was both feeling very almost undersensitized. And I found my memory got very bad during the first lockdown. I couldn't remember, I kept on having mind things and not being able to recall stuff and all that. So there's that, but then there was a sort of over-sensitization on the other side, the constant ramping up of narratives and bombarding with stats and, you know, the constant rigmarole press conferences. And I wonder whether it's sort of even worse than the picture you're describing. It was like, it's that constant level of low-level stress, which is eventually just, you know, knackering.
Yeah. And in fact, can I just add on, because she did add that even though we are sort of almost back to normal, the threat is still there. We're still hearing the ONS numbers. We're still getting death toll infection rates. So we shouldn't be surprised that we're still feeling a little bit under threat, because we are. There is still an invisible enemy out there. So it's good time.
I was in London, obviously, a lot this week, and the reaction team were meeting, and I was at various events and things, and it felt kind of normal. Actually, people keep going on about how damaged London is, but I think it's quite exhilerating at the moment, actually. I can't speak for other cities, being, you know, London's a focus for me at the moment. But it, yes, certain parts of it are bombed out and the retail thing is changing, but I think there is, you just get the sense of energy. I think a lot of people are really glad.
The city felt like normal yesterday.
Yeah, city's back being busy, or certainly where we were yesterday, Maggie. But it, I think another factor must also just be the way in which, I feel that a lot of people report this, just their sense of time has shifted. And that must be because the things we used to do, they were the bookmarks of the year. Like the sort of trips you made to family at certain times of the year, the role that Easter played, with or without religion, Easter, the break in the summer, the way in which, yes, of course, you can get sun in the UK, but that burst of foreign travel, in political terms, party conferences, you know, all of those sort of, you built, there were five or six pillars to your year. And actually, just the problem with lockdown and COVID in general was just, 1 week and 1 month being much the same as the next, which is, but I think the world is back. He said optimistically, but I've been quite bullish about that all year. My pick next, which is related to the budget, Maggie, we're talking separately about what we thought of the budget, but it's a piece from my colleague at the Times, James Forsyth, which is about Rishi Sunak's budget. Sunak pushes big state tourism to its limits. And of course, James Forsyth, political editor of The Spectator, has known Rishi Sunak for a long, long time, has a very good insight into him. And James alights on something which I also thought was really strange about the budget speech, where you had 50 minutes to an hour of splashing the cash around and £150 billion, endless money for everything. And then you just had this weird little coda at the end, which is a bit like Rishi saying, you know, a big boy next door made me do it. In which he gave this, which he presented this critique, almost attack on the notion of big government, which he's just spent the previous 50 minutes posing with money. As James says, in his budget peroration, Rishi Sunak made his personal choice clear After almost an hour on his feet, the Chancellor suddenly became more animated as he asserted that Britain had to get out of the COVID mindset of thinking government could solve every problem by throwing at it, even though he'd spent the previous 50 minutes throwing out 150 billion, which just struck me as kind of weird. It maybe speaks to the sense of stress and tension that Sunak feels, that he feels he's got to do this because this is what a Keynesian prime minister, Boris Johnson. But it is, I can't think of a parallel with a chancellor who's presented a budget, which he then at the end flips 180 degrees and presents an ideological counter. Maggie, we'll talk about the budget later. Mm. So, I mean, let's move on to Wolfgang Bunschau's piece that you wanted to highlight.
Yeah, well, it's sort of timely with our latest fishing wars going on, which to some extent, I think the way the French are, wouldn't I, overreacting, that Macron obviously feels under great pressure. And it's quite interesting to note that in the latest polls for the next candidate, for the Les Républicains party, which will be voted on in a month's time, is Michel Barnier. I'd be very interested to see what he would be doing now, how he would be treating us over the fishing. But it is interesting that he is by far and away probably the favourite to succeed, although the other chap, Xavier Bertrand, has the support of the internal party. But you've also got, so I think Barnier could be quite, if he were to win it, could be quite dangerous for Macron, actually. He does look and sound very much the elder statesman. He's toned down a lot of his rhetoric, but upped it on the, you know, sovereignty issues like that. And at the same time, from the other side, you've got Eric Zemmour, the TV journalist, who some say is Aunt France's answer to Trump, or perhaps being kind, his answer to Boris Johnson, who is, although he says he self-identifies as a Gaullist, so he disputes this far-right tag.
Yeah.
But he hasn't declared yet, but it's likely that he will enter the ring too. So you'll have a sort of face-off between Zemmour and Le Pen fighting for the far-right and then Barnier and Macron for the middle. So I think we're going to have some very interesting months ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to highlight the cover story. It's actually from last week's Spectator, Plan Z by Freddie Gray on the rise of Eric Zemmour. Freddie Gray's just terrific, really interesting piece, which makes the case. I mean, Zemmour's not remotely my cup of tea, but you can see Freddie maps out potentially, it's very early days, what might be happening is that what he threatens to do is to, and what makes him so terrifying to the existing political class, writes Freddie Gray, is that he threatens to unite the right in an essentially conservative country. Zemmour is better positioned to sweep up the centre ground too, with his culture war wizardry and his Trump-Johnson-like ability to render the media apoplectic. He can always annoy the snobs enough to keep the plebs happy, but he can also woo middle and upper middle class French people, Catholics, as well as small business owners and secular liberals. As I said, not my cup of tea. Alistair, you've been watching Zemmour videos to improve your French, I think.
Yeah, well, I watch, it's not an ideological thing. I watch Macron videos as well, and anything I find it's because they speak so clearly, or tend to, Macron does as well. It's really good to improve your French. But Zemmour in particular is very, very sort of quite easy to understand in lots of ways. But I honestly find him very, very intriguing. I saw an Atlantic article where it said Zemmour was, you know, Trumpism comes to France. He's not like Trump. He's super... he's very, very clever, and that makes him very, very dangerous. And I think he's wrong about France and the nature of France, and he's wrong about France's this world role, and he's wrong on his accounts of history. And I think he's wrong about almost everything. But he knows what he's doing. He's very, very clever, and he's cleverer than Marine Le Pen by a long stretch. And he has the cunning of her father, plus the kind of ability to magically jump in tone, which Jean-Marie Le Pen didn't have. He was always very sneering, very, very aggressive. Zemmour is much, much cleverer. And I think, yeah, I look at that and I think, yeah, Freddie's Gray's right there in terms of the Catholic right in France is actually quite a strong feature of French history, which hasn't, it's always there. And it actually sort of little bit surfaced with the debate over when Notre Dame burnt down, because Notre Dame is seen as like the heart of France, but it's the heart of an older France than the Republic. It's a kind of soul of the last 1,000 years of French history.
Yeah.
And France is a much more, it's, you know, Republican values, you know, I find them, you know, that they're just one part of a kind of shifting historical world in France, which is kind of fascinating. But yeah, I think Zemmour, I find him really magnetic good point. To watch, yeah. I find him quite terrifying, actually.
I agree. But it's a really, really good point about Notre Dame, where you could see that the argument flipped to being, because it had that position that you described, or has that position in French national life and mythology that you described, you could see the secularists also feeling some sense of ownership of the place and wanting then to try and, there were the proposals, weren't there, to remake it almost in a secular or a modern or postmodern way. And you can understand the annoyance of French Catholics and saying, no, actually that space, it is a church.
Yeah.
I think we also need to think a little bit about the effect of jihadist terrorist acts in France, I think has actually been quite different to the UK. It's been much more like a national, yeah, like a source of real national angst. And well, also, I mean, we all know this, but it's actually a different phenomenon in France. The killing of priests, which has seen, you know, repeatedly carried out, the poor teacher. It's a much more, it's an issue which has a very, very different, again, this is a banal thing to say, but it strikes me when Zemmour was even talking about it. It's just we have a different debate over here.
You're hitting a totally different phenomena in France, because it's the personal and cultural, because of their colonial history. You just can't compare it to the jihadism here. So what, 6 million Algerians and then Moroccans living in the heart of France. We don't have really anything comparable. But just going back to the Catholic point, what's really interesting that I've picked up from a lot of French friends is that a lot of people used to hide that they were Catholics, the whole sort of secularism. And it's sort of, you know, it's sort of thing you wouldn't talk about at dinner parties. Now it's much more open. And whether it's a response to the whole debate about Islam, I don't know. But it's certainly...
Similar things are happening elsewhere. And that must be a response to the rise of identity politics. That if a radical groups say, look, identity is identity, and that terrible word intersectionality is everything, then existing other groups will then say, well, our identity counts. Shall we move on to the next choice, which I think, Alistair, is from you. It's about Squid Games, which you're going to have to explain to me and maybe some of the audience. I have absolutely no idea what it is, or
he's already advised us not to
watch the story you're highlighting means.
Well, it's a South Korean television show which has been hosted by Netflix, so obviously has had a global, you know, it's number one trending across the world.
They know what they're doing, yeah.
Yeah, and I've seen a bit of South Korean drama, and I think people were, it's a very violent program, but a lot of South Korean films are incredibly violent. So that's not surprising. But it's a kind of, the idea is that, you know, people who are in debt or in facing, you know, or in debt to criminal gangs or have lost all their money, which is a huge, in South Korea, it's a massive sort of cultural thing. Being in debt, the shame of it. Also, after the financial crash, it really hit the South Korean economy very hard. And it addresses those issues. So in this sort of dystopian world, these people are offered the chance to play in a series of children's games, in a kind of sealed off environment for a cash prize. So they win all the money and then they can go back into society and pay off their debts. And the kind of big idea of the program is, although the world outside is unequal and dark, at least, and the world inside the games is very violent, because the alternative, you know, the choice is winning or death. It's not, you don't get to draw or anything like that. At least in the world inside, you compete with a degree of equality. So it kind of makes, it's a kind of on the nose satire of modern kind of techno capitalism, basically, because the games kind of mirror, they're children's games, but the kind of logic of them often mirrors kind of real world situations in adult life, which is what game playing often does anyway. But anyway, so
and the piece that you highlighted from The Guardian, Stuart Jeffries, is an interview with Squid Game's creator. I'm not that rich. It's not like Netflix paid me a bonus, he says.
Well, it's a really good interview because he just says it's not a very profound program, which I think is great, and kind of refuses to get like that drawn into a kind of, because it isn't that profound. It's like, it is a slightly on the nose satire of, like, you know, the kind of the rules that we play that are often perceived to be the kind of unequal rules we play it under and all that.
Yeah.
And then it gets extremely on the nose towards the end, to the point where it's just like, I kind of thought this is rubbish, but it does get to the heart. The program gets to the heart of something, which is an interesting feature of contemporary filmmaking across the world, is people love films about games, or like about specific, you know, in the kind of formal sense, like specific scenarios where you can game the rules in your own interest. And there's like a place you can go where you can actually win against the casino. I think people definitely feel a lot of kind of connection to that. The film Uncut Gems, which is a sort of, if you've ever seen it, is like a defining film for our era, I think, which is the set in New York and set in this kind of inveterate gambler played by Adam Sandler, who loves basketball and bets on it. I thought was a very era defining film. And I just wonder whether there's a kind of connection with the kind of way people really loved watching these kind of people competing in these games in a kind of sealed off place, and sort of loved being that voyeur, like seeing it and seeing people fail or win. I just thought,
well, this
definitely gets to the heart of something.
This connects perfectly to the final item, which is for me. And you mentioned gaming there, Alistair, which is this enormous global industry. I remember a conversation recently with asking some person who's a big investor in that space, as they say, is there not at some point, if people are going to live in this gaming universe, is there not some way of introducing news? To which he said, no, not really. There's no news applications at all. People are going to get away from the world rather than have sort of news pop up. But the thing that I wanted to mention, the final pick from me, is just a little short video, I think 2 minutes and 20, from Facebook. Must stop calling them that. What are they called? Metabook or Metaverse or whatever they've rebranded themselves as this week, which is about this new universe or metaverse which Facebook wants us to live in. And the video is just worth watching. We'll put the link to it below. Incidentally, if you're not a subscriber to Reaction on YouTube, just hit that subscribe button and also like the video and press reviews on every week. But it's a video in which Mark Zuckerberg interviews or has a conversation with Nick Clegg, and they're trying to explain this new universe. As Helen Lewis of The Atlantic, put it, isn't it just brilliant? Here's one area of sort of human activity, human interaction, sort of basic conversation. And actually, why can't Facebook or Metaverse put itself in the middle there and monetize that? What a great thought. And the idea is that you can live via your glasses in a world of perpetual communication. And as Zuckerberg said in an interview with Ben Thompson on all of this, he said, isn't it great? You'll be able to still have your messages coming in on your glasses or your headset or whatever
rubbish you're going to wear while you're having a conversation with someone else, and they won't actually notice. And he said this as though this is a good thing, you know, which another blow to civility, basic human interaction, and you know, and all the rest of it. Did you see the video, either of you?
Yeah, I did. And the exchange between Zuckerberg and Nick Clegg was just one of the creepiest exchanges I think I've ever seen. I mean, and that brings me on to my final choice.
Just before you do, I just wanted to highlight Michael Steen saying, saying it's very meta to get a Brit to do the "we aren't the baddies" bit in a video aimed at a US audience that is used to seeing Brits play the bad guys. I just find it hilarious, just considering what Clegg did to the Liberal Democrats, the destruction he wrought to the party that he led. Well, maybe now he's going to do it to Facebook or Metaverse or whatever. But sorry, Maggie, you wanted to flag up something else.
Well, yes, I was going to flag up a piece actually on our site by David Waywell, who's just a great writer.
Really,
and
good.
He wrote this lovely sort of, what's the word? A sort of goodbye piece, if you like, to Nick Clegg. The day before Zuckerberg announced Meta, he didn't even know this video was coming out. And as he said, the downfall of Clegg from those wonderful benign days of the Rose Garden coalition, so much hope, this man was deputy prime minister, and there he is now, you know, facing, well, it was a period, you know, for a lot of people, broad coalition.
Not for me.
But he has the most wonderful expression. He says he is now the apologist for an algorithm, an advocate on behalf of a complex piece of dumb code that elevates the risible over the reasonable. Anyway, it's really worth reading.
But yeah, no, I mean, I was always a Clegg skeptic, and wasn't that keen really on the coalition. And I always thought the strangest thing about Clegg, and considering that his shtick was a kind of pious technocrat, calm, reasonable thing. How could anyone not trust him? The irony was that he became unpopular in the UK because of reversing his position on student tuition fees. Now, put to one side whether or not that's the correct position, he had campaigned, he'd campaigned for essentially a freeze. He'd campaigned against, you know, increasing tuition fees, but he had opposed that policy as Liberal Democrat leader. He'd lost the battle. He'd said essentially, we can't advocate this policy in general election because in coalition negotiations we may have to do something different. But he still went and posed alongside all these students and stuff during the 2010 general election campaign, saying, I'm on your side against these, you know, terrible proposed increases in tuition fees, but knowing that he'd opposed it. Rather than just sort of dodging the subject, for that reason, I've always been a Clegg skeptic. But I think we're going to wrap things up there on that note. Nick Clegg, Facebook, and there's the link to their hilarious short video below.
That was Press Review. I'm Francesca Peacock, and you've been listening to the Reaction Podcast. Until next week, thank you for listening.